I think there is also a misconception about what's happening. You know, I think right now what we're dealing with is information warfare, a lot of propaganda on all sides. You see pro-Palestinian protesters taking the streets, even here in Salt Lake. Yeah. We've gone up there and we've actually taken photos and videos of some of the protests going on here. New York City, you're seeing that rampant. You know, most major cities, you're seeing a very vocal protest to what's going on overseas. So would you just give us just a high level of what's been going on since October 7th to today? We're filming February of 24, but a lot has happened. And I think there's a lot to unpack here with what's going on, not just politically, but also it seems like it's shaping culture in a way.
And welcome to We Are the People Radio. This is your host, Jason Preston, and again with my beautiful Brad. How you doing, baby?
Excellent.
Yes. And today we got a really cool guest coming on that we're excited to have, someone that we actually met from Epoch Times that we're very excited about. But before we jump into that, just want to thank our sponsors of the show, which is you guys. Just thank you to you guys who have been supporting us, doing donations on the website. We are doing everything we can to produce a quality show and to produce more of these and to put money into advertising to get this out so that we can start challenging the mainstream media more and getting what's really happening in this state out there and so that we can start bringing about change. So I want to thank you guys for supporting us and helping us pull this off. And make sure, I always say follow us on YouTube or Rumble, but now we're just telling people just go to the website and sign up for our newsletter. And that way, if they take down one of our channels again, you'll get the newsletter and we can, boom, well, we won't miss a beat. We're going to keep going. So with that being said, we are pretty excited about who we've got coming on. I'm going to turn it over to my lovely lady to introduce her.
Thank you, baby. Well, Karis, thank you for joining us today. We have via Zoom, Karis Rhea. She is a producer of American Thought Leaders. You might have seen that incredible program. Especially the Utah Surveillance State program we did back last October. And she's also the producer of Fallout at Epoch Times and a fellow with the Jewish Leadership Project. She also works with the Middle East Forum and Bast Records. She has appeared on Newsmax, OAN, Real America's Voice, NTD News, and a variety of podcasts. And her articles can be found in Commentary, New York Daily News, Newsweek, The Federalist, Washington Examiner, and more. She has a BA from NYU in broadcast journalism and an MA in counterterrorism and homeland security from the Reichman University in Israel. A former life found her touring the world as a drummer and songwriter. That's pretty cool.
I like it.
Before becoming disillusioned with the political and cultural arrogance of the music industry. She continues to release music in her spare time, in addition to publishing absurdist flash fiction. You can find her on Twitter at Rhea, that's R-H-E-A, Karis, K-A-R-Y-S. Karis, thank you so much for joining us.
I guess you're kind of a big deal.
Thank you, guys. I don't think anybody's read out my entire bio. I think they kind of get tired after the second sentence. So thank you guys for that.
You're a big deal. We love it.
Yeah. So awesome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys.
So we enjoyed getting to meet you when we were part of your program. But where things got really interesting was after we realized we both share a Jewish heritage. And ever since October 7th, I think Israel has been something on everybody's mind. And that's here domestically in the States and even in the state of Utah. I think there is also a misconception about what's happening. You know, I think right now what we're dealing with is information warfare, a lot of propaganda on all sides. You see pro-Palestinian protesters taking the streets, even here in Salt Lake. Yeah. We've gone up there and we've actually taken photos and videos of some of the protests going on here. New York City, you're seeing that rampant. You know, most major cities, you're seeing a very vocal protest to what's going on overseas. So would you just give us just a high level of what's been going on since October 7th to today? We're filming February of 24, but a lot has happened. And I think there's a lot to unpack here with what's going on, not just politically, but also it seems like it's shaping culture in a way.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, people like me who've been in this Zionist pro-Israel advocacy movement for well over a decade, we've kind of been trying to raise the alarm bells for quite some time. You know, people have, especially conservatives, have been talking about wokeness and the dangers of progressivism and far leftism for quite some time. And a lot of elements of this ideology have been at the forefront of conservative media, right? The transgenderism, the critical race theory, open borders, right? There's a lot of different elements to this leftist ideology. But one thing that really hasn't kind of been included in the coverage of woke ideology is anti-Semitism, which is such a core component of it. And people like me have been, you know, screaming from the rooftops, like, this is fundamental to this ideology. And I think what October 7th did is it really brought that to the forefront, and it opened people's eyes who just weren't generally aware of the role that Jew hatred in the form of anti-Zionism has played in this ideology.
So let's back up for a minute. You know, we're talking mostly predominantly to population of Utah, which is mostly LDS. Then you also, of course, have the contrast to that. But for those people watching, even those outside of Utah, can you explain the difference between, well, what is a Zionist for one? And then also just, you know, how is that different than being Jewish?
Well, can I jump in? Because, yeah, because I'm curious about that. Because when you mentioned you're a Zionist, I hear a lot of people talk about Zionist as a bad thing. And so, you know, the bankers and the, you know, the
Rothschilds,
yeah, and the people who are kind of running the world. And I think that stems from a lot of people saying, you know, concern of I don't know. I think that's where a lot of the people who are like frustrated with Israel right now, and I think it stems from that. And to me, I see like a real obviously difference between the Rothschilds and the people who are trying to rule the world. And you know, I mean, my wife is obviously Jewish. So yeah, tell us, what is a Zionist? Because I think the thing that comes to my mind when people talk about Zionist is actually a bad thing. So tell us about that.
Right. Yeah. So political Zionism is very, very simple. It's a belief that Jews as a people, with a distinct language, culture, history, tradition, nation, have a right to self-determination like any other people on earth in their indigenous homeland of Israel, where they lived consistently. They've lived consistently for thousands of years, despite, a large population being exiled and pushed out at certain times by different colonial invaders, and then coming back and then leaving again. There was always a consistent presence from biblical times all the way until today, depending on, you know, how large or, you know, with different sizes of the population, sometimes very small, sometimes very large, like in the time of the first and second temples. And, but I think that it's sometimes hard for people to grasp anti-Semitism, because it works a little bit differently than other forms of hatred. Like when you think of like anti-Black racism or homophobia, right? Or somebody being anti-women, usually this hatred stems from a belief that this minority of people are lesser than, they're like subhuman, right? And that does exist in anti-Semitism too, certainly, right? I mean, during the Holocaust, Jews were considered vermin and rats and pigs, and you still see that today in some of the, cartoons and caricatures by, you know, white supremacists and stuff. But anti-Semitism also punches up instead of down, which means that fundamentally at its core, anti-Semitism is a conspiracy. It's this belief that there is a small cabal of Jews that are pulling the strings, controlling the world and have sinister intentions, right? So what's so funny about that is, if that were the case, we're pretty horrible at it. I just have to say, you know, losing, you know, 2/3 of our population in the Holocaust in Europe, one out of every three Jews on earth, and countless expulsions and pogroms and forced conversions throughout Europe and the Middle East. And yet, you know, from the beginning, you know, from the first belief that the Jews killed Christ to the idea now that, you know, the Rothschilds control the world, you see a thread of this conspiracy that this small group of people wield incredible power. And that's the same thing that we see in anti-Zionist ideology today, where instead of the individual Jew, you have the collective Jew. So you have all of the same tropes. There's these kind of classic medieval anti-Semitic tropes that have persisted through the years, and they kind of morph to fit the needs of any given society, because Jews are always the scapegoat, because again, you need somebody to blame for your problems, and it always ends up being the Jews poisoning the wells, or, you know, bringing the plague, or, you know, whatever it is, or being responsible for 9/11. But anti-Zionists, what they do is they take these tropes and they just replace the word Jew with Zionist or Israeli. So instead of, you know, the Jews controlling the media, it's Zionists controlling the media. It's instead of the Jewish lobby, it's the Israeli lobby, right? Instead of the Jew being this sinister, you know, evil, manipulative character, it's now Israel being this, you know, demonic, evil state. You know, instead of the Jew not having the right to live freely and belong in you know, and be and have equal rights among society, now it's Israel not allowed to have equal rights among nations. Israel must be singled out as the collective Jew. So it's really different sides of the same coin. And once you really understand how anti-Semitism operates, it becomes very obvious. But if you don't understand that, then it can be very, very difficult to detect, because anti-Zionists hide under the guise of not being anti-Semitic and just being anti-Zionist. I have nothing against Jews. I'm only against Zionists. But people have done polls, you know, in different countries, and then averaged them out throughout the world. And they've found that upwards of 90% of Jews basically consider themselves Zionists, meaning they support the state of Israel. So if you say, I'm just anti-Zionist and not anti-Semitic, you're basically against 90% of Jews. It doesn't really add up, you know?
So Zionists are basically Jews who believe that they have the right to live on that land, Jerusalem, that is their land, their homeland. Is that it? Is that correct?
Yeah, the right to live there and also to express their faith and their culture freely. Absolutely. Yeah. People say it's Zionism is the Jewish civil rights movement. Some people kind of refer to it that way. It's also been referred to as the national liberation movement of the Jews.
I think what's hard is that, I mean, that makes perfect sense.
Well, and the other thing that's interesting about it all, this seems to even cross political lines. You see conservatives
right,
actually speaking out against Zionism and even Holocaust deniers. I mean, that's
Stu Peters.
We never would expect to find things like that. I mean, to even take, it was hard enough for us seeing the education system with certain AP classes taking the Holocaust out of schools. I mean, and these things come in layers, you know. First it will affect the schools and the kids, and then it will come in and affect society, and then before you know it will be a rewritten history.
So that's a good point. Like, and obviously, you know, Stu Peters, he is very much pushing this, and even I think Alexi mentioned that he's saying he denies the Holocaust. Is that right?
Yeah, he went through census records and found the population of Jews from the 20th century. What's interesting that I'm sure, you know, many Jews would know is if you get pregnant and you go to the doctor, one of the things they'll do, especially as an Ashkenazi Jew, is they'll do a special blood work because Jews were so cut down in population during the Holocaust that they now have to do special tests that are expensive tests for Ashkenazi and other types of Jews because there's been such a limited population of the Jewish culture because of events like the Holocaust where there was known genocide. So, I mean, there's one thing to have propaganda and misinformation, but when you see it cross political lines and you have conservatives being as vocal, and conversely, you're seeing the left and liberals now have a red pill moment with what's happened in Israel in October because they're seeing, oh, well, BLM is showing images with paragliders. Mm-hmm. I gave money to BLM, so I now have to make a choice here. Am I a Jew? Or am I a liberal that supports BLM? So I think it's across the board, and it's been an interesting thing to see because you don't have many things, historical events, where it's a red pill moment for some, but there's still so much cloudiness with the misinformation that's out there that nobody knows what to make of truth anymore.
So I have a question for you then on that.
Oh, sure.
So she brings up a very good point. You have obviously the left and the liberals who are pro-Palestine.
Well,
yeah. And kind of calling out Israel. And then you also have some conservatives on the other side saying that, you know, like Stu Peters. What's your thoughts? Yeah. Why are the conservatives, why are the conservatives calling out the Jews right now?
Right. Calling out Jerusalem? Yeah. Those are such astute observations, and it's something I've thought about a lot. And when we think about the political spectrum, when it comes to anti-Semitism, it's not so much a line, right, where you have left and right. It's kind of like a line at first, but the further you go in either direction, it really like loops back around and kind of tends more like a horseshoe. And that's why there's actually a phrase, it's called horseshoe anti-Semitism. And what that means is essentially it's a type of hatred that really unites people on the left and the right. And this is why you have people like David Duke praising people like Ilhan Omar. It's why you have, you know, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel so popular, you know, among leftist college students and faculty and administrators, but also a fundamental feature of, you know, white supremacist groups. They also want to boycott Israel. They call it the Zio state or something like that. So it's very much uniting, and I think it's because throughout history, again, if anti-Semitism is a conspiracy, then Jews can be blamed for whatever the needs of a given society are. So if you want to be, if you look back throughout history, Jews have been demonized for being communist, but they've also been demonized for being capitalist. Right, Karl Marx. He was, despite coming from a Jewish family, he was a known anti-Semite. He hated the Jew. Obviously, you know, Marxism is anti-religion, but more than that, he saw Jews as greedy capitalists. Right. So you have the white supremacists on the right. He was. I think he converted or something, but he definitely did not identify as Jewish, though his roots were. But yeah. So you have. You have white supremacists that think of Jews as these, you know, liberal, kind of impure defilers and manipulators who bring about immigration and, you know, who are for open borders and who are pushing globalism and all this kind of stuff. And then on the left, you have the exact opposite. They see the Jews as, you know, the greedy capitalists. And so it's just a hatred that really, really unites. And we definitely see just example after example about that. And I think it really comes down to the fact that anti-Semitism is a conspiracy. And that's also, I think, why it can be very hard for people to spot, especially today on the conservative side, because so many conspiracy theories over the last few years have turned out to be true. When anybody is labeled a conspiracy theorist, we now just like roll our eyes, right? Because we've all gotten it. We've all been called conspiracy theorists. And we know, you know, that term has just largely lost meaning to us, you know? But there are conspiracy theorists out there. You pointed out Holocaust denial. That is still rampant. That, you know, and we are now for the first time seeing a modern day version of that, which they're calling 10/7 denialism. There's a lot of people on the far right, but more on the left, that are denying that October 7th happened at all, or questioning it in the same exact way that people have questioned the Holocaust. They say, oh, not, you know, 1,200 people didn't really die. Oh, it was an inside job. The Israeli soldiers did it. You know, all the same kind of classic mechanisms. So, yeah, I hope that answers your question.
that's very good.
You know, it's funny. We were talking about the stereotypes that develop that stem out of that anti-Semitism. And you're talking about the Jews being the greedy capitalists. And it made me think of some of the propaganda we've showed from the Soviet Union, from the kulaks. Yeah. That's been translated.
Exactly.
So, I mean, it's interesting because even though this is uncharted territory, it really isn't. You know, this is stuff that we've seen before. I mean, we've talked about the 1973 Yom Kippur Wars and what that did to Israel, and we haven't seen anything in Israel since then. But, I mean, there is a lot of cyclical patterns that we know what is going to come next. So, in talking about that,
You brought up Soviet Union and I think the Soviet Union has tell us about the Soviet Union, because we talked about this before. Tell us about the Soviet Union and their role in shaping perception of Israel and the Jews. And is it the Soviet Union or the Soviet Union and China? Tell us about that.
You know, China has their own history of anti-Semitism, and that's actually a really interesting topic that I would not be the most qualified to speak about. Tuvia Gehring, he's a researcher who's written a lot about that. No, I mean, this really stems from Soviet Union ideology. I mean, when we're talking about anti-Zionism, people just assume that this is some sort of organic human rights grassroots movement that is about defending the Palestinians. But in reality, this is a top-down, decades-long delegitimization campaign that is well-documented from the Soviet Union that started in the really in the 50s, but really took off in the 60s after the Six-Day War. And what happened is you have to look at it in terms of the Cold War. Because after World War II, you know, two superpowers had emerged, the USA and the Soviet Union. And you had this new country, right? The reestablishment of Israel, 1948. And there was a question, who was Israel going to ally with, the Soviet Union or the U.S.? And a lot of people thought it was going to ally with the Soviet Union. Why? Because there's a lot of socialistic elements in Israeli culture. You have kibbutzim, right, which are little communes that still exist throughout Israel. They say it's the closest thing we have to working communism, right? It's like these very small communities throughout Israel that where you know, everybody kind of knows each other and works together, and usually each kibbutz is in charge for one type of resource, you know, textiles or making granola or whatever, you know, and everybody works and pitches in on their kibbutz, and it's beautiful, and you know, and it's a tradition that goes back a very long time that's still very prevalent today. And there was also, you know, there wasn't much privatization. The state, you know, I mean, how the state, when they were forming the state, they decided that the state was going to control a lot of elements of society, like water and you know, there was going to be, you know, what have you, all of other sorts of things, you know. But to everyone's surprise, Israel allied with the U.S. And actually the Soviet Union, this is why the Soviet Union was actually the first UN nation to acknowledge the state of Israel. after the vote, after Israel declared independence, after the partition plan, and then Israel declared independence. But Israel allied with the U.S., and this was a massive, massive blow to the Soviet Union, right? Because at that time, they were really kind of looking for spheres of influence, right? Like they were looking for fronts around the world that they could control, right? And Israel was a huge stake in the Middle Eastern front, right?
Ironically, if people actually knew at the time what was happening in the Soviet Union, they were killing Jews. And they were killing, you know.
Oh, no doubt.
I mean, they were killing no Jews. Doubt. They were killing, you know, pastors. They were killing, you know, religious leaders. I mean, they were killing. Those were the people that were getting killed off.
Well, the only religion that was acceptable was the state.
The state. So,
of course.
That's the irony of them trying to think they could partner with Israel when, you know, they were literally killing off the Jews in Soviet Union.
Well, right. Because right. Well, the entire intelligentsia was killed off. So any, and obviously any religion was not welcome in the Soviet Union, and anti-Semitism was rampant in the Soviet Union. I mean, Stalin is known as like the arch anti-Semite, and there was huge waves of Jewish refugees, two primary waves in the 1800s and the 1900s, when Jews left the Soviet Union fleeing persecution and came to Israel. And that's why there's such a huge Russian population of Jews in Israel. So, sorry for the noise. That's my cat running around. She's got a little bell on her. I should have taken it off. But this was a really problematic for the Soviet Union, right? Because the Soviet Union couldn't have, you know, the U.S. controlling this region. The Soviet Union needed a stake in this region. So what they started doing is they started arming Israel's enemies and, the Arabs, and they started funding anti-Zionist militias and terrorist groups, right? They funded and basically created the PLO and Yasser Arafat. They, Mahmoud Abbas, the current president of the Palestinian Authority, he wrote his dissertation in Russia about Holocaust denial, basically. But more than that, more than just allying with Arabs and funding them and creating groups that opposed Israel, is they began a massive propaganda campaign. I mean, this is what we all know the Soviet Union does best. I mean, they allocated countless resources to delegitimizing Israel as a state. And the way that they did this is they literally appropriated Nazi propaganda. Like literally, they took the same posters, right, with like the octopus tentacles, right, like or you know the Jews with the big noses, and they took the same messaging and the same curriculum, translated into Russian, and they just switched out the word Jew for Zionist, and they distributed that far and wide in brochures, in magazines, in films, and books were written, And it wasn't just kept in, it wasn't just distributed throughout the Soviet Union. They distributed it throughout the world along with their own Soviet and anti-American ideology. The anti-Zionist component was part of all of their training. So when they went throughout the world and, you know, they were, looking for groups to train and control in Soviet ideology, anti-Zionism was always a part of that ideology. And they targeted it to specific parts of the world based on the issues that that region was grappling with, right? So they targeted South Africa very heavily, which, as we know today, South Africa just took Israel to the International Court of Justice, accusing them of genocide. That's the whole other can of worms, right? They very, very heavily targeted groups in the U.S. that they saw were anti-American, right? For example, Black Power movements like the Nation of Islam or SNCC, or SNCC used to be aligned with MLK, but they kind of split off and went in like a Marxist direction. groups like that, groups like the Black Panthers, you know, and people like Angela Davis, the Soviet Union would bring them over to the Soviet Union, and they would train them in their entire ideology. And then they would come back into the States. And now, as we know, those are the people teaching in on our college campuses. So all those people that are teaching Marxism and affecting our education system and creating this new nihilistic generation of you know, anti-American troubled youth who, are don't value like family and religion and tradition, these teachers are also teaching them anti-Zionist ideology. And that is why you see such an explosion of protests around the country and also in Europe of anti-Israel like students and young people that are going around, because this is they're indoctrinated in it. Ethnic studies is a mandatory state curriculum in California now, and in this curriculum they teach kids that Israel and only Israel is deserving, and the U.S. of course, but we are in the U.S. so would make sense, but this tiny country all the way, like thousands of miles away, the size of New Jersey with 9 million people of it, is the country that is deserving of our condemnation and the only one that deserves to be boycotted and singled out. I mean, do you ever hear anybody else talking about another country's right to exist, right? Like we talk about how horrible the CCP is, or the Iranian regime, or the North Korean regime, but do we ever sit around talking about whether China has a right to exist or Iran has a right to exist? Of course not. Israel is the only country that is singled out and held to that double standard. And one last thing I'll say about that, this Soviet campaign culminated in what's called the Zionism is Racism Resolution in 1975, where the Soviet Union had been pushing to kind of get this delegitimization of Israel codified into international law. And they kept bringing this resolution to the table. I think they tried for over a decade. And then finally it passed in the United Nations in 1975. And there was a resolution that basically stated that Zionism is racist. It is racism. Now, obviously, that resolution has been repealed. But, you see those slogans today. Like these slogans are, these slogans about Zionism being racist and all that kind of stuff. I mean, they're just talking points of the Soviet Union.
You know, it reminded me of, you're talking about the propaganda. It reminded me of the interview Tucker just did with Putin. And one of the things that Putin said is that you guys own the propaganda machine. You're talking about the U.S. And in a sense, he's right. But there's a real irony in that, is that the propaganda machine in the U.S. was actually started in the USSR. The USSR, the Marxism, it's amazing how powerful Marxism has been in this world since it came in, because it kind of seemed like it got snuffed out, but it didn't get snuffed out. It got pushed into the United States through their mm-hmm. propaganda mm-hmm. and all of our, our school systems. If you look at, John Dewey, the founder of our modern school system, he was about Fabian socialist, Marxist,
right?
Media, the schools. So this Marxist propaganda, this which started in the Soviet Union, completely infiltrated the U.S. And then you had these U.S.
It was institutionalized.
It was institutionalized, and then we mastered it. It's the same Marxist propaganda that has taken down this country apart. So, and it's now coming full circle as American propaganda, but in reality, it is all Marxist propaganda that is being pushed throughout the world right now. And the irony, Putin sits there, and he knows this. He knows that this, the civil war happening in America, the collapse of our borders, the collapse of our dollar. He knows it is the Marxist efforts coming into fruition, and they're waiting to pounce on it, to take America down, because that's been their plan since. I mean, it's been stated since the 40s and the 50s that was their plan, to take America through infiltration. So it's interesting to hear about that's part of their propaganda. It wasn't just affected, folks on America, but also Israel.
I have personally witnessed the heart-rending results of the loss of freedom. I have talked face to face with the godless communist leaders. It may surprise you to learn that I was host to Mr. Khrushchev for a half day when he visited the United States. Not that I'm proud of it. I opposed his coming then, and I still feel it was a mistake to welcome this atheistic murderer as a state visitor. But according to President Eisenhower, Khrushchev had expressed a desire to learn something of American agriculture. And after seeing Russian agriculture, I can understand why. As we talked face to face, he indicated that my grandchildren would live under communism. After assuring him that I expected to do all in my power to assure that his and all other grandchildren will live under freedom, he arrogantly declared in substance, "You Americans are so gullible. No, you won't accept communism outright, but we'll keep feeding you small doses of socialism until you finally wake up and find you already have communism. We won't have to fight you. We'll so weaken your economy until you fall like overripe fruit into our hands."
And, right. And
I'm glad it.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm glad you brought up that interview, because I feel like a lot of conservatives, at least I've been seeing on Twitter, they're really praising Putin for this interview. And I don't know if they realize that you brought this up the other day, Jason, that like Putin is allied with the CCP. Like there is a new axis of evil here. You got Iran, China, and Putin, and you know, some say North Korea is a part of that, or maybe Turkey as well. I think it's hard for people to be able to sometimes hold two thoughts at once. Like people think that, okay, we shouldn't be giving Ukraine these blank checks, like 100%. Ukraine is a very corrupt country, 100%, right? Like this, you know, this is like this could be a forever war that ends up being funded by globalists like BlackRock and everything, 100%. But that doesn't mean that Putin is a good guy and that he doesn't have expansionist ambitions. And it doesn't mean that he's pro-America. And just because he, like you said, he can take these, the cultural destruction happening in America, and he can point out all the debauchery and our border crisis and the wokeness and the drug addiction, whatever. Just because he seems like he agrees with us on that, it doesn't mean that that's the case. This is a seasoned KGB operative here.
Yes.
The booker of American Thought Leaders, she wrote like a whole thing about it. I was like, you should really post that on Twitter. She had a very emotional reaction to it. And she's like, Putin had Tucker for breakfast. I mean, he really did.
He did. It's funny because I'm 100% with you. And I know we had this conversation, but it's like Putin is so masterful. And I mean, again, they have brought this country to its knees. Marxism has brought this country to its knees. And, for them, and again, when you look at all the Marxist strategies where they break down, this has been documented for years, and you can read this, it about you pushing homosexuality, you pushing all these agendas, you destroy the moral fabric of society, you put the people at war with each other, everything happening, you destroy the borders, everything happening was written and documented in these Marxist documents of how to take America down. And it comes from them. It comes from the KGB. So yeah. He's just sitting there like pointing, oh, look what's happening. That is their plan that's come to fruition. And then the conservatives are here, look at him like, wow, look at Putin. He's such a conservative. No, he's aligned with the CCP. And they're waiting for this country to come to its knees. And once it comes to its knees, they will attack.
Right.
But the problem is you can't, yeah. You can't be dishing out black pills. It's human nature that we need to have some hope that there not all is lost. We can't know that Ukraine is bad, China's bad, Russia's bad. I mean, for them, mm-hmm. this is the ultimate black pill moment. So it's human right. nature to hope that there's somewhere in there, and whether it's for them, Trump, to come back and save us, there needs to be something to hold that, because the moral fabric of society is already falling apart with all of the above, the transgenderism, the wokeism, what have you. You want to have that hope that maybe there is a good guy in the thing, in the grand scheme of things. Mm-hmm. But when it comes down to it, the only hero here is the truth.
Well, and I'll add one more layer of the bad news is that the fact of the matter is there's no question Israel has its own deep state. And I think that's one of the things that people are frustrated by is just mm-hmm. like America. But, you know, America is like has a massive deep state, which is completely working. You know, again, it's our borders are open. It's not like a bad decision. It's not like a old man just not, I mean, leaving the weapons, you know, in
Afghanistan,
opening our borders, destroying our dollar, using the media to put the people at war with each other, creating civil war, calling, burning down the cities, peaceful protests. And meanwhile, when you've got a few people and old ladies, you know, going into the Capitol, locking them down as political prisoners, going after the former president, we have a very real deep state in America, but that doesn't mean America is bad. And I think right. that's the problem people don't associate with Israel. It's, yes, there's no question Israel has a deep state, but that doesn't mean Israel is bad. And I think that's where people are not connecting the dots.
Certainly Israel's bureaucracy is bad. I lived there for a year, so I experienced it every day. But, you know, Israel's deep state is not like America's, except for the fact that there is one. It's a very small country. People are very, very connected to each other. Like, in America, what it takes for, like, somebody to who's just, like, you know, a normal, like, civilian to, like, get to the president, to meet the president, you know, that's, like, hundreds of steps to get up there. But in Israel, like, that's, like, four steps for everybody. I mean, it's a tiny country. And like I said, it's the size of New Jersey, and half of all of the world's Jews live in Israel. So not as much can happen behind the scenes without it getting out in Israel. And I think another point to make, I think one of the things that conservatives are frustrated about, I think we talked about this yesterday when we were on the phone, is I think they lump, because Biden had that, you know, ridiculous proposal, you know, that he's trying to pass of lumping in aid to Israel with aid to Ukraine. And so I think now the conservatives see Israel as just another Ukraine. People like Candace Owens and, you know, a lot of other pundits, even Tucker Carlson, they're kind of looking at Israel and they're like, oh, this is just another war that we're funding, that we're sending a blank check to. But that's just not the case. And I want to be clear about why. First of all, the conversation about aid to Israel is 100% an important conversation to have. Okay. And I am one of those, and not all Zionists believe that we should be sending $3.8 billion a year to Israel. I personally don't believe it, not even because it's not good for America, but also because it's not good for Israel. After the 1973 war, Israel started like offloading all of their production to America. And, you know, 10/7 is a perfect example of that completely failed approach. I think Israel needs to be procuring and developing and manufacturing all of its military production on its own soil. And so I think that it's really important for Israel to wean itself off of that aid over time. And I think that there should be markers, and I think that that should end. But I also think that people should understand that this aid, this $3.8 billion, is nothing like the money that we hand to Ukraine. This aid, quote unquote, is not really aid. And that's why I put it in quotes. It actually has very specific conditions attached to it. Like, for example, 75% of it has to be spent in the U.S., which means that this so-called aid actually employs tens of thousands of Americans with jobs. If you look at a city like Boston, for example, a lot of this aid is spent in Boston. And so there's a lot of MOUs between Israel and the city of Boston, because they're very happy about these jobs that now people have. as a result of these agreements between the two countries and this friendly relationship. And another thing about the aid is, we get valuable intelligence that when I was a grad student and learning about counterterrorism, I learned about the amount of terrorist attacks that could have happened on our soil that were foiled because of intelligence that Israel provided. I think people like to create patterns and they want to be able to come up with a big story of kind of how the geopolitical world looks. But sometimes it's important to look at each situation separately and then come to a conclusion about like each specific situation and not just, generalize.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that war is good business, and it's a terrible way to look at it. But there's money. There's a reason neocons are pushing for it in Washington, because it brings money also stateside. But, I mean, I think the ideal here is not to push more business and money into the economy. The ultimate goal should be peace. I just don't think we're heading in that direction.
No, and I think...
But one other thing really quick that I wanted to say is that, and I made this point to you guys yesterday, is that Israel really shouldn't be singled out the way it is for getting this much money, because it's actually a drop in the bucket when you look at the fact that we don't have any troops on the ground in Israel. We don't fight Israel's wars. We don't put boots on the ground there like we do everywhere else. How many troops do we still have throughout like Europe, right? And South America and other parts of the Middle East, right? So if you look at the amount of like the manpower and the resources that we spend on other countries' defense, if you compare those two things, it's really not that much that we do for Israel.
Yeah, I think my big concern is that our founding fathers had a very strong stance on entanglement with foreign alliances. I don't think there's a lot of constitutional grounds on the amount of money we're sending to. In fact, I mean, when we are paying now, I think $1 trillion in debt. That's the interest. Is it now $1 trillion? Is that right? $1 trillion a year in debt, I think, is our interest alone. Mm-hmm. When our military is on the brink, like our military is not strong. We've sent off most of our ammunition to Ukraine. Again, our borders are under siege. Our dollars,
Afghanistan.
What we left there, which is going to go to China, and here we are. The people are getting played, but this is a game between these globalists to get us into World War III. That's what this is with China and Ukraine. Weaken America and get us into World War III. China will attack Taiwan. Iran is going to get more engaged with Israel. And then guess what? Mm-hmm. Now we're engaged with Russia, we're engaged with China, and we're engaged with Iran. And we are in massive trouble. And that is the ultimate goal of these globalists, is to take America down. We are the threat.
I agree with you.
So when you see what's happened in Ukraine and you see Israel, again, I think people are saying, and rightfully so, they're saying, wait a minute. And as soon as Russia checks Taiwan, they're going to say, wait a minute again. Are we setting ourselves up for destruction by all these foreign entanglements, sending money, sending our troops? And again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't, be supporting Israel at all. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying I understand why people are concerned, and they absolutely should be, because we are not prepared for World War III. With our president, our borders, our economy, our military, we have never been so vulnerable. And to be all over the world building empires, which is what we've become, an empire, which has created so many enemies. I can understand people's concern with moving towards World War III.
Well, I can understand the concern as well. And I think those questions are important to ask. But, when we're talking about like anti-Zionism and singling out Israel, I think the fact that liberals and conservatives alike are outraged over this aid that we send to Israel, but you never hear them talk about the aid that we send to Egypt. I think that just points to maybe like, the hypocrisy and the double standard. Absolutely. That Israel is held to as a Jewish state. When people talk about the Israel lobby, but you never hear anybody talk about the Qatar lobby. Qatar is the richest country on earth, and they own more real estate in New York, I think, than any other nation. You can't go a city block in DC without finding Qatari influence. They bought the congressional baseball game. They owned, you know, they bought think tanks. They have put billions into our universities. I mean, so the fact that people are singling out Israel for these things, but they're not, they can ask themselves the right questions, but the fact that it always lands on Israel, I think that's concerning.
It is.
I think that points to a deeper issue.
And it also leaves our borders vulnerable when we can't reach deals and everything is baked in for overseas aid. And as we saw in Israel, the borders are where you are vulnerable. And we were talking earlier about the kibbutzim on the borders. I mean, we don't have kibbutzim at our borders or any type of commune.
I don't think our listeners speak Jewish.
Well, she already explained.
I speak Jewish. I love that. I'm going to start saying that. I speak Jewish. I love that. Well, you know, the other it's thing, though, Hebrew, the other thing I think... there was one other thing I was going to say. It was that I sympathize and I understand the desire that, like, you know, conservatives, increasingly libertarians and isolationists have for America to kind of focus on our own problems, which are, like you said, just completely eroding the fabric of our nation. But I don't think it's like an all or nothing gamble, because I think we have to also remember what made America a superpower to begin with. And it wasn't just our, you know, incredible Judeo-Christian values and our love of liberty and freedom and our constitution. It wasn't only those things. It was also the fact that the world relied on us, and small nations looked up to America and believed that we had their back. If there was a rogue actor that would, you know, would a rogue expansionist or imperialist actor that would, you know, aggress upon that small nation, that they could look to America to save them. And if America, if we don't have allies, if we are so isolationist that we won't come to anybody's rescue, then nobody will come to ours. And these actors like the CCP and, you know, like the Ayatollahs in Iran, they are both committed to the destruction of America, because America represents Western civilization and Judeo-Christian values. And so if Iran takes down Israel and the CCP takes down Taiwan, like, America is not isolated from that. They will be coming to America eventually, because that is their end goal. It's America. They're not going to stop at Israel or Taiwan. So we need to defend these countries from these rogue actors, because it is in our interest, because these actors have made it clear that they want nothing less than the destruction of America. The problem is that we don't do it in a smart way. The problem is that, like you said, it ends up being this horrific globalist, you know, these globalist actors come into play, and we end up just throwing money around, don't know who it's actually ending up, like whose hands is actually ending up in. And we just don't, you know, and we don't seem to learn from history. We don't seem to learn the lessons. And I think that's really the problem, is that, you know, it ends up just being this bureaucratic free-for-all, and we just end up suffering from it.
I think the problem is we have leadership that is not looking out for the best interests of our country. I think they are looking for the Great Reset and being a part of this new world order, period. It's clear that they are not looking out for America. Everything happening across this country is not a series of bad decisions. I cannot buy that. These people are intelligent. I think they sense the dollar's coming to an end, the dollar's in trouble, the BRICS nations are gaining momentum. I think that we have become a nation led by people who do not stand for what America used to stand for, and they want to see a new world order come in. And I think they've made it, and that's out of their own words. So yeah. So it's frustrating, but it was really powerful hearing what you had to talk about with the propaganda machine coming out of Russia and Soviet Union. And the money that they then sent, that actually brings in a lot of context to why Iran is so tied to Russia right now still. Because when you understand that piece of the pie of the relation between China and Israel, or excuse me, Russia and Israel, it makes everything else start to fit together of why you have Iran backed by Russia and America supporting Israel.
It's a very weird, kind of like a unholy alliance between like the Marxist left who, you know, ostensibly hate religion and want to build godless societies and burn down all the churches. And then these incredibly conservative, like Islamo-fascist, theocratic, you know, countries who, you know, impose, you know, Sharia law and, you know, onto its citizens and where jihadism is a substantial, you know, force, throughout the Middle East and certainly in Europe. And yet they've like come together as allies, not just, you know, on the geopolitical stage, but also, you know, in the streets and on our college campuses, right? The people with the keffiyehs and I think it's because that even though they have very different visions for the world, they are united in their hatred for the West and their hatred for Judeo-Christian values. So it's like, you know, friend of my friend is my enemy or something like that, right? Yeah, it's like that kind of thing. They have like a greater calling that unites them together.
Yeah, 100%.
And there was this, do you know Billboard Chris?
What is Billboard
Chris? He's that guy who, he has a Twitter account and it's amazing. He goes around the world and he's just like this concerned dad from Canada. We just had him on our show who's just absolutely horrified by all the gender stuff. And he goes around the world with this billboard on that says children cannot consent to puberty blockers. And he just has conversations with people and he films them and he puts them on Twitter and he's become quite a face of social media. And he went to an anti-Israel protest and there was this incredible moment that he caught on camera, which didn't even have to do with gender or anything. And it just kind of really illuminated kind of the whole like intersectional, the whole intersectional hierarchy, where one person came up to him and he was like an Antifa guy, I think, you know, dressed in black, and he started complaining to Chris and calling him transphobic and all this kind of stuff. And then these two Muslim girls came up and they're like, "What's going on?" And the Antifa was like, the Antifa guy was like, "This guy's saying that, you know, people shouldn't be trans or something." And the Muslim girls were like, "They shouldn't." And then they started like arguing and the Muslim girls were like, no, this is against our religion. Like, you know, like you can't like, and it was just, and then he was like, "Oh no." And then he just skipped, you know, kind of like ran away. And it was just, it just showed you how these people come together for these greater goals. But ultimately, like they have very different visions for, you know, their own cultures and their own societies. And at the end of the day, if they were successful in taking down the West, they would be coming for each other next. They would be in a civil war, no doubt.
Yeah.
So curious, as we wrap up here, I think the question that I think I really want to pose for you and also for our viewers is this is a show about basically Utah and the corruption of Utah. And why something on such a global scale should matter to a state that's a fraction of the size of Israel. We only have 3 million people in the state of Utah. Mm-hmm. It creates a very unique community here, especially for the LDS community, which I think in a way is a reason enough that it should matter. It's a community and a religion that understands persecution and forms of genocide. So I think it should hit home. It also should hit home because as we talk about Zionism, what I hear is nationalism. And I see that being something under attack here in America today, as they call it, you know, the enemy is this Christian nationalism group, which expands to the Judeo-Christian nationalism group as being the enemy. So I think what we are talking about, even though we're talking about it on a global and macro scale, is very, very relevant to the states here domestically, particularly Utah, because of the faith-based culture here. So to you, why should something, a global war outside of, you know, affecting the environment that we live in a war environment, why should it matter to a state like Utah or any state in the United States right now?
Right. It's a great question. I think that Douglas Murray, who was just in Israel, he got on a podcast with Winston Marshall, and I'll send you a clip of it if you want to show it. And he said at the end of the interview, he said, the world shouldn't be singling out Israel and asking Israel to be more like the world. We should be looking at Israel and asking how the world can be more like Israel. I see Israel as really, I mean, maybe not the last, I mean, also European countries, I think, or sorry, Eastern European countries are also, I think, a bastion of hope in this fight against like globalism and you know, and wokeness, since they've really suffered under communism. But Israel too, I really, really, especially as being the cradle of like Judeo-Christian civilization, I really, really see it as like the last beacon of hope for like Western democracies and tradition and family. If you go to Israel, you will just be, you know, so moved by the sense of community and family there. You know, everybody becomes very close in the army. They have lasting friendships, and you know, there's these there's what's called lone soldiers, which are soldiers that don't have family there, and they're always taken in by somebody's family on Shabbat, because you know, on Shabbat the entire country kind of shuts down and everybody has dinner with their family and friends, and there's nobody that doesn't have somewhere to go, because there's going to be some, because if a family sees that somebody is alone, they take them in. And it's just even in terms of demographics, it's a beacon of hope. If you look at the birth rates, right? Like, I think every single Western country has a declining birth rate, right? As these immigrant populations are going up and having all these kids, it's incredibly threatening, especially in places like Western Europe, right? Where you have these negative birth rates, but you have, you know, people coming, for example, from like Muslim nations, and they're having all these kids, and it's really eroding the national fabric, right? And yet Israel, not even among the religious population, but even the secular Israelis are having like on average, like 3 kids per family. It's incredible. So I think the reason why it matters for a place like Utah or any state for that matter is that if Israel goes, I don't really see much hope for the West. I really don't. I really don't. And I think that we should, remember that when we see, you know, anti-Zionist movements like take hold in our local communities. I think we should remember that if Utah sees their city council going to try to pass like a boycott Israel resolution, or, you know, they see, you know, anti-Zionist curriculum being taught in schools. Like, I think that it's important to push back against that, because, you know, we're all tied by this love of tradition and faith and family and country and freedom. And Israel is the only place in the entire Middle East that believes in those things and is actually practicing them. So, you know, I think that's pretty valuable to preserve.
But I think that the LDS culture in Utah geographically, there are parallels here. So, you know, maybe it's an isolationist way of looking at it, or a myopic way of looking at it, but I think selfishly, Utah could say, you know, this could easily be something that we contend with. The LDS faith, when they were persecuted, they had to be nomadic and find this land themselves. So I think that for Utah specifically, I think there is a special interest to the Jewish people, because it is a reflection of their own.
Yeah, that's what's. Karis, you're amazing.
Thank you guys so much. I mean, it was so much fun talking with you about this, and thanks for giving me a platform. And I hope your viewers find it valuable and interesting.
Oh, I'm sure they will. And we'll do something again with you for sure. We really appreciate
it. Great. Yeah.
Well, thank
Wonderful.
You for joining us.
Yeah. Well, you're a thank rock you. Star, and keep out there tearing it up. And you know, everything you're doing with the Epoch Times and everything you're doing on your own, it's exciting. It's amazing because people are very hungry for truth right now. So you're killing it.
Yeah. Well, I would say the same exact thing to you guys. Awesome. Keep doing what you're doing.
You got it. Thank you so much, Karis. And to our listeners, thank you guys for listening. Thank you for joining. And just honestly, thank you guys for the support. We've just been so appreciating support, especially since our YouTube got taken down and we've been rebuilding. It's been just really amazing to see all the support out there. And this is really a great, incredible time to be alive. And what's going on in Israel right now, it's hard to say. It's not, I mean, I think so many people talk about our day and time and feel like we live in really prophetic times. It is an amazing time to be alive. And I really think what's happening in Israel right now matters. There's a reason we wanted to have Karis on. This is an incredible time to be alive. And what a time not only to be alive, but to be helping shape history. And that's, we all have a role to play in that. So thank you guys for joining, and God bless America, and God bless Utah.